Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour is all about how diet, what we eat, impacts our brain power and overall health. Joining us a little bit later, Patrick Schlievert will be with us, professor and head of microbiology and immunology at the University of Iowa College of Medicine, to talk about gut health and some of the research that's been done here. But first of all, joining us, neuroscientist and nutritionist Lisa Mosconi. She's the author of a new book called Brain Food, The Surprising Science of Eating for Cognitive Power. And she joins us by telephone. Lisa Mosconi, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
I wanted to mention that you're associate director of the Alzheimer's Prevention Clinic at Weill Cornell Medical College. It's in New York. Formerly, you were founder and director of the Nutrition and Brain Fitness Lab at New York University School of Medicine, also assistant professor at NYU's Department of Psychiatry, where you served as the director of the Family History of Alzheimer's Disease Research Program. We want to reach out to our callers this hour. Questions this hour that you have about diet and brain health. Do you do something specific, eat things, not eat things, because you think it's healthy for your brain? This is the hour to ask our experts on that. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100, or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Lisa Mosconi, give us, broadly speaking, what's contained in this new book. What is the connection between our food choices and cognitive function, our brain power?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. I think as a society, we're comfortable with the idea that we feed our bodies, but we're less comfortable or maybe less aware that we feed our brains too, and that the foods we eat, sure, they do change the way we look, but they also change the way we think, and we need to refocus attention on that. Some foods will help us age gracefully and achieve and maintain mental performance, while other foods will have the opposite effect. They will harm our brains and increase the risk of cognitive decline and dementia. Mm-hmm. So this is what the book is about.
And tell us, what are some top brain foods on the good list? And then we'll get to the avoid list.
Yes. So research, including my own work, has shown that some foods are really neuroprotective. So they literally protect and shield the brain from harm. And there are many foods, and usually I'm asked for the top five, so I'll give you the top five. So from a purely scientific perspective, caviar is the best brain food. And I understand it's expensive. I get it. I understand it's not practical. But from a scientific perspective, the nutritional composition of caviar is really a fantastic complement to whatever nutrients your brain needs for health and cognitive fitness. Now, again, I understand caviar is expensive. I'm very much aware of that. And so fatty fish would be the best alternative. Mm-hmm. Fatty fish like salmon, trout, herring, bluefish, but also sardines and anchovies are really, really good for your brain because they're very rich in a special kind of fat that your brain needs on a daily basis for health.
And we want to make sure that the source of those seafoods, for instance, is given attention, right? Because are some seafoods we hear about sort of heavy metals and other toxins that can be in farmed seafoods, for instance.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Many people are worried about the mercury content of some fish. And that's a very reasonable concern. I think usually wild-caught fish is healthier than farmed fish. And it's not necessarily more or overly expensive. I think it's easy to buy wild Alaskan salmon in cans. And I think Bumblebee even has a variety, and they carry that in most supermarkets. So it's accessible. We just need to to refocus attention on how important and how helpful it is for health.
Mm-hmm. Now, we know dementia is a looming health crisis facing retiring yes. baby boomers, and you are at the Alzheimer's Prevention Clinic there at Cornell Medical yes. College. What do we know about diet's connection to dementia, to Alzheimer's? Can we prevent dementia with better diet or delay its onset from what we know?
Right. So I think it's really important to clarify what Alzheimer's is and what Alzheimer's is not. And I've been working in the field for a good 15 years. And when I started, most people understood Alzheimer's as either an inevitable outcome of aging or as a consequence of bad genes in your DNA or both. And little by little, it's really become clear that genes are not your DNA is not the destiny, and that aging is not just a linear path to dementia. And whether that's good news or not, it really depends on where other things fall for us in other respects, like lifestyle and especially diet. There is now consensus that at least one-third of all Alzheimer's cases could potentially be prevented by improving our lifestyle choices, cardiovascular fitness, keeping our brains intellectually stimulated, and, of course, eating better. So a diet plays a big role in determining whether or not we will age gracefully or develop cognitive decline mm-hmm. and possibly dementia as we get older.
And what about memory? Can we eat certain foods, have a certain lifestyle to improve our memory?
Yes, yes, certainly. Brain foods in general have a powerful action in the brain. And also, I think focusing on the good foods and avoiding other kinds of foods like processed foods, fast foods, deep fried foods is very helpful because processed foods and fried foods and fast food, they really increase inflammation in the body. And inflammation is very harmful everywhere inside the body, but also in the brain. So it's a combination of things. It's a combination of eating certain things and not eating other things. And our research in particular has shown that your diet really has a strong effect on the chemistry and the structure and function of your brain. And we have shown this using brain imaging. So my background is in neuroscience and nuclear medicine, which really is kind of code for brain imaging. So we do brain scans in our patients, and we try and correlate their diet and their nutritional quality with whatever is going on inside their brains, how active their brain is, how structurally solid and sound their brain is, and how much Alzheimer's pathology, how many Alzheimer's plaques they're actually showing. And we're showing really strong correlation when people are fairly young, like in their 40s and 50s.
Mm-hmm. So you can, with now the modern brain imaging methods, positron emission tomography, PET, or the magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, you could yes. image someone's brain and tell me and see if they had a poor brain diet or a healthy brain diet?
So there's evidence for strong effects of diet on the brain. For instance, we published quite a few papers showing that if you take a group of people who follow a Mediterranean-style diet and another group of people of the same age, education, balanced by sex, and this other group of people actually have been on a Western diet for a substantial amount of time, when you look and at their brains and compare their brains, you'll see that those on the Western diet show increased brain shrinkage as compared to those on the Mediterranean diet. They will show reduced brain activity. They'll show more Alzheimer's pathology, more Alzheimer's plaques. And that's in midlife, like 40s, 50s. Mm-hmm. So that's a good 20 years prior to a possible onset of clinical symptoms of dementia, which is usually in the 70s.
If you just joined us, Lisa Mosconi is one of my guests today. Brain Food, the Surprising Science of Eating for Cognitive Power, her latest book. She's a neuroscientist, a nutritionist, and recommending the top five foods contained in this brain food book, the ones also to avoid. Let me run through those the list very quickly. You mentioned fish, berries on the list, dark leafy greens, extra virgin olive oil, whole grains, and wow, I'm happy about number six that you stuck in as a bonus, dark chocolate. Foods to avoid at all times you have in your book, fast food, as you mentioned, white sugar, white flour and its derivatives, soda, and processed meats. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Any questions you have about diet and brain health, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Joining us now as well, Patrick Schlievert is a professor and chair of the Department of Microbiology and Immunology at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. He's also a professor of internal medicine. Patrick Schlievert, welcome back to our program.
And thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
You've been listening to Lisa there talk a little bit about brain health. I'd like to get your angle on it because I know you also research Alzheimer's and brain health. What is your angle here?
Well, so let me first say that I agree with almost everything that she said. And I think in particular, activity, diet, and intellectual stimulation can delay onset of Alzheimer's. I think that was one of the most important things that she said. But I think also the composition of our gut flora, the microbes that live in our gut, as we call them, the microbiome, influences it, what happens to us emotionally, our ability to sleep, multiple sclerosis, dementias. And so they have a major effect. And, of course, that is influenced by the diet that we eat.
So talk a little bit more about that microbiome because it's really fascinating. We've been hearing about it for years now, how important it is for our mental health, for our physical health. There are a lot of little, I don't know, creatures in our bodies, more cells in our guts than what in the rest of our body?
Yes. Per bowel movement, there's about 200 trillion bacteria. That's an awful lot of bacteria. It's more than most people can even imagine what that really means. But it's a massive, massive number. Now, the one thing I would like to say, though, is that when we start out as babies, and a lot of babies today are breastfed, their microbiome is governed by really two bacteria, lactobacilli, as we call them, and bifidobacteria. And that's why breastfed baby poop doesn't smell bad. It's because they're dominating. Okay,
right.
But then as soon as you go on formula and start other foods, now the microbiome changes, and we start picking up a lot of good bacteria, but also a lot of bad bacteria. So then, as Lisa was saying, what you eat then governs how many of those good and bad bacteria you have. The more you can keep these lactobacilli and bifidobacteria as dominant, the better off you will be, the more you can delay onset of Alzheimer's and some of these other things. The less of those, so if you eat more fatty foods and fried foods, you're going to start selecting for more of the bad bacteria, and you'll start making people more susceptible or accelerate the process towards emotional problems, multiple sclerosis, and the dementias.
So we know now, we have data, Patrick, that tells us that our gut health may be connected with the onset of dementia?
We absolutely do. We do. And I wanted also, so our ability to sleep, but also our ability, some people develop multiple sclerosis, but also dementias are all linked to those. And a lot of it is when you have too many of the bad bacteria, your immune system has a tough time telling the difference between you and them. And so you get what we call cross-reactivity. And so that's how some people then are thought to end up with, for example, multiple sclerosis. Likewise, when you get too many of these bad bacteria, some of them get in your bloodstream, and your body is trying to deal with them. And sometimes you end up with these amyloid beta plaques and tangles and things. in your body trying to control those, and they're kind of misfoldings that lead to that. And likewise, your ability to sleep depends on having enough good bacteria. We know this because there are amino acids that bacteria can make that humans cannot make. So how do you find those bacteria or those bacterial amino acids in the brain? And, you know, so they're carried there by your immune system.
And if
to
they're
the brain.
Not, if they're not there present in the gut, then they cannot make it to the brain.
That is correct. Okay, mm-hmm. So your ability to sleep depends on having the right microbes in your gut. So I always liken it to you could go out and have, you know, really tie one on, have a really hot, spicy pizza, a lot of beer.
Yep.
Really mess up your gut flora. Or you could be high anxiety and really mess up your gut flora. Those things are going to interfere with your ability to sleep then.
Very interesting. Lisa Moscone, in your book, Brain Food, you talk about the microbiome and also probiotics, don't you?
Yes, I mentioned that. I completely agree with Dr. Schleiver that this is a very important connection between gut health and brain health. It is still under exploration, and I certainly hope to see much more research done in that field, because it's really an emerging field that is so fascinating. I do mention in the book that we need both prebiotics and probiotics for optimal gut health. Prebiotics are usually found in carbohydrate-rich foods. They're carbohydrates like oligosaccharides. And what happens in the gut is that the good bacteria need oligosaccharides, so very specific kind of sugars, basically to feed themselves. They eat these sugars to have energy and stay alive. So we really need to feed the good bacteria in our guts. And at the same time, probiotics can help because they kind of replenish whatever good bacteria we have lost.
Mm-hmm. You, in your book, Lisa Moscone, also in one chapter, you focus on the areas in the world where people tend to have particularly healthy diets for their brains. We notice you have a charming Italian accent. You are a native of Italy.
I am.
I think one of the healthy brain, healthy areas of the world is Sardinia, off of Italy. Is that correct?
Yes. The Sardinia is an island in Italy. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful island, and it's one of the blue zones. They're called the blue zones. These are parts of the world where we find the largest communities of centenarians, so people who live to age 100 or older with their mental capacities intact, which is amazing, really. Some communities are found in Italy, in Greece, but also in Japan. For instance, Okinawa is an island off Japan with the highest concentration of female centenarians in the world. And another longevity hub is found in South America, and then another one actually in the United States, in California. And when you look at the lifestyle of these communities, in spite of the fact that they are so far from each other geographically, their lifestyle is quite similar. They share very common principles, especially as diet is concerned. For instance, they do not consume processed foods, right? They do not eat fast food. They do not really eat deep-fried food. They do not use preservatives. They do not use artificial sweeteners. They don't really consume a lot of refined grains or refined sugar. Their diets are mostly plant-based, and some of the communities, like in Japan, they tend to eat veggies three times a day for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. They're mostly consuming plant-based foods with fruit as well, of course, and healthy grains, whole grains, and then fish is usually a staple in many of these diets, and very small amounts of animal foods. They drink clear water, which is also very important, fresh spring water instead of purified water or soda or seltzer. And overall, they seem to have a very balanced approach to life. You know, like Dr. Schleiber was mentioning, sleep they certainly sleep much more than us and much better. They seem to have less stress than we have in their lives. They're physically active all the way. I mean, they're 100 years old, and they just keep climbing mountains, which is really fascinating. And they're also very socially active. They have a strong sense of belonging in the community, and they help, and they're being helped and supported.
So we see a lot of inputs here, not only diet but lifestyle as well, Patrick Slievert, in terms of the healthiest places on the planet. Are we adopting that? You've had decades of work in this area, Patrick Slievert. Do you notice, I mean, how far have we come in understanding how much our gut plays a role in our mental and physical health in the last 10, 20, 30 years?
Well, I think most of the research has been really in the last 10 years. And I think we're relatively speaking at the fairly at the beginning. And I think the NIH has made a great effort to infuse a lot of money into these studies. But I do want to mention, I think one thing that all of these things have in common, mm-hmm. and Lisa mentioned this earlier, is inflammation. Chronic inflammation is bad. And a lot of these bad diet microbes and stresses and things that we do in our lives cause inflammation. So this isn't quite dementia, but dementia would be the same way. But one of the bad microbes to be selecting for would be Staph aureus. And Staph aureus can cause chronic inflammation, and it can lead people into diabetes mellitus too. Okay, and it can lead to insulin resistance, which defines it. So these chronic inflammatory processes are bad. And what Lisa was saying, all the things these places have ways of kind of regulating or down-regulating those inflammatory processes. And one of the best ways we can do that is reducing stress and eating right.
Mm-hmm. Is that fairly new, the recognition that inflammation is really an enemy here of our body's health?
Yes, because for a long time, inflammation has always been thought to be good. It's how we get well, right? When we scuff our knee, it gets inflamed and you get over it. But actually, anti-inflammation is actually better for you. And so a lot of these inflammatory processes that we get are bad. I call it bad inflammation.
Okay. Fascinating discussion with Patrick Slievert of the University of Iowa. Lisa Mosconi, we're talking about our diet and its connection to our health. We'd like to have you join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. When we come back, I want to ask some specific questions about probiotics. U.S. consumers bought nearly $400 million worth of carbonated fermented tea. Perhaps you have too. Kombucha in 2014. I'll ask about that when we come back. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking with neuroscientist and nutritionist Lisa Mosconi. Brain Food is the title of her new book, The Surprising Science of Eating for Cognitive Power. Also with us, of the University of Iowa, microbiologist Patrick Slievert. He is the professor and head of microbiology and immunology at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. A fascinating conversation about how we're finding more and more our gut health is so important. Our diet is so important, not only for our physical health, but also our mental health. Join us, 1-866-780-9100. We'll get to questions from our listeners in just a moment. I wanted to turn to Patrick Slievert here because to ask about research going on at the University of Iowa. Well, I mentioned before the break, probiotics, and your lab is really doing some interesting cutting-edge research in this area. Tell us about it.
Okay. Yeah, we think this is one of the most interesting findings that has been made for quite some time in this area. So a lot of people are familiar with yogurt and actually taking probiotic capsules that have lactobacillus in them. What we found is there are certain lactobacillus strains that They don't just make hydrogen peroxide and acids, but they actually make compounds, other compounds, that are not toxic to us, but they kill off bad bacteria. And so what we would like to know is, can we use those as better probiotics to recolonize people, for example, to recolonize people that have had Clostridium difficile infections, or to just change people's bad microbes that they have in their microbiome into these good ones, because these will kill off others.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so it's interesting. So you're creating, if you kind of think about it as a neighborhood, you want all the good bacteria to be there, and then you not only want them to populate it, but they're giving off these acids that the bad bacteria don't like and won't come into your neighborhood.
That is correct. And we're actually making those environments more like what breastfed babies have.
Oh, interesting. Lisa, anything to add to that? We have so many probiotics out there. We have yogurts, kefir. We have the kombucha. Kombucha. Sorry, these are all pretty much sort of all probiotics that are good for us. Or are there some that are better than others, as far as you know?
I defer to Dr. Schlievert about that.
Okay. would you say these are all sort of all good for us?
Well, knowing the microbes that are in there, yes, I'd say they're all good for us. But I do think there are better ways, and we're going to develop in the next few years really very, very good ways of doing this. For example, what's going on in my lab? I mean, I don't want to be too strongly supportive of myself, but I want to say that this was a really interesting finding, that these microbes that we have found, these lactobacilli, which like to live on us, on our gut and our other mucous membranes, that they are actually found a way to keep other microbes out, the bad ones out.
So how do you think, if you look at the applications in the years to come, what will be the revolutionary change? Will we be taking certain types of probiotic capsules in the future?
Yes, we'll either be taking capsules or we'll even be eating yogurt. These are the same lactobacilli that can be found in yogurt. Mm-hmm. It's just that we're selecting the ones that we want, not the ones that are naturally out there.
Oh, I see.
So there are some, for example, there are some lactobacilli that actually cause inflammation, and those are ones we don't want. Okay, so what we want is these ones that don't cause inflammation, but also kill off the bad bacteria.
Very specific.
And we have the ability to do that now.
Okay, very specific lactobacilli in our guts
in
the future. Let's go to our phones, get a few questions answered. Let's start off with Judy in Des Moines. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the program. Judy, you're on the air. Welcome. You're Trudy.
Yes,
Trudy. I'm sorry. I misread that.
Thank you. I have a question for the two guests, wondering if they have heard of a physician, a cardiologist in California, a Dr. Steve Grundy, Gundry, who is very much working on its products to help gut health. And one is called the Lectin Shield, that one is to take two capsules before two meals, full meals a day, and it works against the bad lectins that are in the gut, the idea being that it ultimately is to help with gut health. I'm always leery of something like this, but I'm finding it very intriguing. I'm wondering if either guest note has heard of this doctor and
okay.
his research.
Trudy in Des Moines, thank you. Lisa? Or Patrick, have you heard of this particular doctor, Dr. Stephen Gundry? Perhaps Trudy used the word leery, which I think we need to be. There's, Lisa, a lot of pseudoscience out there, I'm sure you can point to, that has no scientific basis. How do you recognize remedies for what we're talking about in the field that we're talking about, brain health, brain power, that may be suspect? What questions do you want to ask yourself when, like Trudy, you hear of something new? And not saying what she said doesn't have any scientific data, but we just don't know.
Right. It's a very legitimate question and concern. I feel like people are confused about diets in general or about pharmaceuticals in general, and I don't blame them. There's so much confusion out there, and there are so many people with so many different ideas. I would say, as a scientist, the way I proceed to evaluate different products is, has there been a clinical trial in humans done? There are many products that are developed in mice and in labs, and there is no guarantee that something that works in mice will actually work in humans. So we need to make sure that the products are tested in clinical trials with real patients and real patient populations, and they need to be phase 3 clinical trials. Usually they're the largest and the most informative in terms of dosage and efficacy and duration and side effects. Usually you want to make sure that clinical trials have been successful.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, does that make sense?
Yeah, Patrick has something to add. Patrick, yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, I have two things to add. One is, I mentioned inflammation, as did Lisa. So mice and humans behave oppositely on inflammation. So she's absolutely right. You need to know what humans are going to respond. In fact, there have been multiple papers that suggest that mice are very poor models wherever inflammation is involved. And inflammation is bad in this case. Now, the other thing is lectins. Every lectin I know of is inflammatory. So I would be leery. I would want to see that tested in humans because, like I said, every lectin I've ever heard of and every one I've used, I use a lot of lectins in the lab, they're all inflammatory.
And inflammation is always bad.
It's, in this case, it's always bad, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Talk more generally. People may wonder about, you know, basic diets, vegetarian diets, vegan diets, someone who eats a lot of pork and beef, as a lot of us do here in Iowa, how that affects our gut health. Patrick, you first.
Okay. Well, so, I mean, I think fruits and vegetables select for good bacteria, and I think that the kind that we want, and I think that a lot of meat, pork, particularly if they're fatty, if they're lean, they're better, but the tendency is to select for bad. So the idea there is if you balance them, then you're kind of balancing it, and you're going to have kind of an average life. You can improve your life and delay onset of dementia and these kind of problems if you emphasize more the leafy vegetable and fruit side, and you can make it worse if you emphasize the other side.
Also, exactly what you point out in your book, Lisa, as well, isn't it?
Yes, I completely agree. I was thinking about research done in the elderly, showing how people on high carbs, low fat diets tend to age better in terms of brain health. And by high carbs, I mean enough plant foods and enough fiber. And low fat would be low animal fat content in the diet. And I think that was correlated with a healthier microbiome and more positive brain aging over time. So it really looks like the foods that you put in your gut actually affect more than just your stomach. They also affect your brain. And we need to plan for, I would say, the same way that we would want to save for retirement, we need to start to eat for retirement. We need to think about the long term, right?
Right.
I think that's a good analogy,
right?
Because so many people, when they make changes to their diets, they're focusing on the present. Like, I want to lose weight. I want to go to a wedding. It's almost summer. I need to slim down. And that's very reasonable. But what we really should consider is also the future and the long-term health of perhaps our most precious organ.
And it sounds, Lisa, like you're saying that no matter what your gut health is, your overall health is, you can reclaim your gut health and populate it with the very good, good things in your gut at any time, no matter if you're in great health or not so great health.
I believe that's the research. The research, I think, is showing that once you change your diet, it takes a short time for the microbiota to change as well. And the positive changes will disappear just as quickly if a healthy diet is then abandoned again for the poor one. So I think we need to stick to one diet that is actually healthy and validated and perhaps supplemented with the healthy probiotics and prebiotics that Dr. Schreiber was talking about, and then we should stick to that. And we need to make it a daily part of our lives.
So I do think that, I agree with that. I do think, though, that you can be too far down the road. I have personal family experience here that I think, you know, once people, so 1.5 million people in the United States have long-time urinary catheters, and they pick mm-hmm. up gut microbes causing those urinary tract infections, and they'll go down the dementia pathway. Once they get mm-hmm. to a point, you can't reverse them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what we need to do is to keep them from going down that pathway in the first place. Hit it as early as you can.
So again, the retirement, saving for
yes,
retirement
absolutely.
is a good way to think about it. Do mm-hmm. it in your 30s, 40s, and then you'll be in great shape when you get into your later stages
absolutely.
Of life.
Absolutely.
Let's go back to our phone. So many people want to talk. Let's get Paul in Des Moines. Hi, Paul. What's your question? Welcome to the program.
Well, yeah. I was wanting to know, besides foods, some of the liquids in our diet, like alcohol. You know, there's a big increase in craft beer sales around the United States and stuff. And I was just wondering, like with craft beer, how that maybe affects the gut biome and the brain. Someone's mentioned soda, but, you know, how coffee maybe affects
okay.
these things.
Okay. Paul's asking about the beverages we have. Patrick, can you comment?
Okay. So one thing that alcohol does of any sort is dehydrates people. That is one of the natural functions of alcohol. You always find that you have to go to the bathroom all the time. So dehydration also interferes with brain function. The more hydrated you are, the better brain function that you have. I think one of the things about coffee is that although some coffee can be healthy, coffee is also very acidic. And so I think my bigger concern there is what it's doing to the stomach rather than the GI tract.
Mm-hmm. Anything to add to that, Lisa?
I completely agree. I would say there is some evidence that red wine could be beneficial for brain health. And usually, at least as far as Alzheimer's prevention is concerned, that's the recommended alcohol of choice. Like if you want to drink alcohol, it would be helpful to focus on red wine because actually it's quite rich in antioxidant and anti-aging compounds. But in small amounts.
Keep
so
in
it
mind.
It would be like one small. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, I was just going to say those antioxidants are anti-inflammatories. So it comes back
right.
to the same.
Right, yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, thank you, Paul in Des Moines. Let's go to Cedar Falls. Lucas is in Cedar Falls. Hi, Lucas. Welcome to the program. Your question.
Hi, my question is kind of based off the last one, but more specifically to the probiotics and how they might work similarly to sour beers, because I'm a home brewer, and there's now a big cult following for sour beers that have lactobacillus in them, and if that might have any healthy properties.
Okay, the craft beer revolution. Is that good for our gut, Patrick?
Well, lactobacilli are always good for our gut, particularly if they're the anti-inflammatory kind, and unfortunately, I don't know what's in those sour beers. Related to that, but if there's enough lactobacilli in there, then it should be helpful. But again, remember, you've got an offsetting effect because you've got the alcohol that's in there that is also a dehydrating effect and just by its nature. So moderation is what I would suggest there and leave it at that. I think we're too early in the game to tell yes or no, whether it's going to be helpful or not.
Lisa, I wonder if I can ask in closing, why is there so much confusion in this area, nutrition and the brain? You've delivered so much good information in your book here, but there's a lot of confusion out there. I'm sure you encounter it.
Oh, yes, for sure. Yes, we have a lot of patients who actually They really get me to learn about the new diet trends. I would say I think there's a lot of confusion because science is not fashion, but we tend to treat it like such. Especially for some reason, especially nutrition. I think everybody can relate to diet and food, and there's a tendency to try and find quick solution to problems. And it's a little strange to me how unbalanced and how extreme we can be with our diets. Like a few years ago, everybody was vegan, and now everybody's eating fat and not touching any grains, right? And actually, I was wondering what Dr. Schlever feels about all these people going on high-fat diets.
Well, so I was going to make just the comment that evolutionarily, our bodies are designed to acquire as much as we can when we can, and we have and so that's why I think people do tend to overeat, and we tend to overeat the wrong things, fat foods. I think really high fat foods are bad no matter when you take them.
Yeah, but when we talk about the brain, Lisa, and I think you write about this in your book as well, is that we have this popular notion that the brain, there's a lot of fat in the brain. It's sort of a custard-like thing, and there's a lot of fat in it. So so any fat that we eat must be good for our brain. That's a myth?
It is, yes. So I found that very surprising when I started talking to patients about diet, really, because, yes, it's true, the brain contains quite a bit of fat, but it's also true that the brain makes its own fat locally on its own when we're little. So basically, fat is usually divided into major fat types, like cholesterol, saturated fat, and polyunsaturated fat. So cholesterol, everybody has heard about cholesterol. It's the thing that your doctors measure in your blood, and you want to keep it nice and low. The thing is, your brain has no use for dietary cholesterol because it just cannot even enter inside the brain. What happens is that the brain is protected by a shield or a barrier that prevents certain nutrients and certain substances from getting in. And cholesterol is the one fat that just will never be able to get inside our brains. So we don't need to eat it at all. Saturated fat is kind of similar. The brain takes up saturated fat from the diet when we're babies, and then a little bit less throughout childhood and even less during adolescence. And then pretty much, by and large, kind of stops needing saturated fat from the diet, so the uptake is really minimal. And the only kind of fat that the brain cannot manufacture internally and that needs to get from the diet is polyunsaturated fat, which is like the omega-3 fatty acids that we talked about before because of fish, the omega-6 that actually pro-inflammatory, but you need a little bit of that as well. So this is So polyunsaturated fatty acids like omega-3 and omega-6 are pretty much the only kinds of fat that the brain needs daily and consistently over time.
Okay, we have a minute, almost 2 minutes left. Leave us with some a recipe. I know you have some in your books, and perhaps Patrick Schlever can tell us about a favorite food or two that he has for brain health. What would you say? Point us to some foods where you're being listened to over the noon hour here in Iowa.
Oh, something. Let's see. Some of my favorite foods. I prefer vegetarian choices or fish. So I would go for a nice Buddha bowl. Do you know what that is?
No.
Buddha, like the Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
It's a vegetarian kind of preparation that combines a lot of different things. Like you have a lot of veggies, fresh and cooked, and nuts and seeds and chickpeas and beans, or grains, all in the same bowl, and then the dressings are fantastic.
Okay.
I have a lot of recipes on my website,
okay,
if anybody's interested.
A Buddha bowl. I'll have to look up that. Your recommendations, Patrick Schlievert?
Well, so I like some mixed vegetables and potatoes that are actually have olive oil on them and then are fried. Mm. And it's a wonderful taste, and I think it's very healthy.
Okay, if you haven't had your lunch, I think we're getting the taste buds going there.
Yep. So,
thank you very much, Patrick Slievert of the University of Iowa College of Medicine. Lisa Moscone's new book, Brain Food, The Surprising Science of Eating for Cognitive Power. Lisa and Patrick, thank you for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And nice meeting you.
River to River is River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Ben Stanton. Also help today from Lulu Dewey. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Of course, Politics Wednesday tomorrow on our program. Jim McCormick is with us, I believe. Also, Dennis Goldford of Drake University. We hope you join us for that conversation. Always plenty going on in the world of politics. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.